It's crazy. I can't believe that Russia has declared war on Ukraine. That as soon as the declaration...
There you go.
Oh, that's a missile. Missile.
That was one of those, like... Oh, Jesus Christ.
All right, we've got to get inside.
An Australian journalist showing what life is like in Ukraine as we speak. Out on the streets, missiles literally flying overhead. And Ukraine's president with a dire message as Russian forces close in on his capital. Quote, the fate of Ukraine is being decided tonight. Ominous words from the leader of 44 million innocent civilians. And then, what do we really know about the two men calling all of the shots in this conflict? The Russian president was once this lovable little boy who grew into an international pariah hell-bent on killing civilians. The Ukrainian president, he was once the funniest man on TV. Both of these men are locked in a global battle, but can either one be trusted with so many lives tonight? They use the word love as part of a scoring system in tennis, but the number 7 ranked player in the world, Russian native Andrei Rublev, was showing no love to President Putin today after advancing to the finals at the Dubai Championship.
2 sets, but Rublev said not so fast. He might just have a message, Andrei Rublev. I think we can get behind that.
No war, please. But all's not fair in love and war, as he may be finding out the hard way. And later, the littlest casualties of war, Ukrainian newborns bundled into a hospital basement, and orphans at the mercy of Russian invaders. I'll be speaking with an aid worker desperately trying to save those little babies tonight. Straight ahead on Banfield. It is poised to be a very long and bloody night of fighting as millions of civilians in Ukraine are both afraid for their lives and for their futures. The threat of a return to the dark days behind the Iron Curtain is hanging right before their very eyes. Amid a new round of air raid sirens going off and a Ukrainian president telling his people they may never see him again alive after tonight. I want to go straight to News Nation's Washington correspondent, Kelly Meyer, who is standing by live tonight. Kelly, this is just sort of a real awakening. This is all within 48 hours, and all of a sudden the president is saying, I may not live through the night. What is President Biden's response to that, or is there one?
Well, right now, we also know that the president had spoke to the Ukrainian President Zelensky earlier today. They talked for about 30 minutes around noon. We don't know if they've been in contact since then. We haven't heard from the White House in these later hours tonight. We know that President Biden is now in Delaware. But we do know from a tweet from the Ukrainian president that he and Biden had talked about strengthening sanctions, defense assistance, and anti-war coalition. He was grateful, he said, to the U.S. for their support to Ukraine. But he also has been critical of the U.S. and others for not pushing back harder on Putin, for not issuing more sanctions sooner to stop him from invading. And as we know, as you were mentioning tonight, Kyiv, the capital, is really running out of time tonight.
Yeah. So, Kelly, look, big, strong, bold moves from Canada, the U.K., the EU, the U.S. today in sanctioning President Putin personally, and if people are watching right now and think, oh, big deal, I've heard of sanctions before. No, this is a massive deal. This makes him a pariah among pariahs. There are only about 4 people out there right now who are suffering this same fate. And he's in the likes of Syria, Sudan, North Korea, and Venezuela. So it is a big deal. And yet still, the Ukrainian president says it's not enough. So is the only thing that's going to be enough for Zelensky and the Ukrainians is if American boots start marching into that quagmire? Is that what the Americans are assuming at this point?
Well, I think what the Ukrainian president wants here, he's been expressing, is he really just wants a ceasefire here. He's saying he wants no more slaughter. He wants this to end. And there was some discussion we saw earlier today that Russia may have been proposing a negotiation, and Ukraine said they were willing to, but Russia proposing that as their forces are closing in on the capital. So whether or not that is in good faith, we just don't know. It's based on their actions, not their words here. But for the U.S. and NATO allies, you know, this all is really over Ukraine saying they want to be a part of NATO, one part of this at least. And the thing is here is that NATO, the NATO alliance, they are sending troops in, the NATO response force, to bolster the allies in the Eastern European region because they have that Article 5 commitment, that ironclad commitment. But Ukraine is not involved in that. So there are no troops, no NATO alliance troops, no active response force. There's no U.S. combat troops going into Ukraine. But the president has said if Putin does move into these NATO countries, then the U.S. would be getting involved here.
So let's talk about that, because that is no small move today. This is the first time ever that the NATO response force has been activated. And that can't be small, even to Zelensky understanding. It doesn't mean they're marching right into your territory, but it can't be small, at least to send the message to Putin, stop. Don't think about another move, because we're all out here and we're all united against you.
That's right. I think what the U.S. and NATO allies are trying to do, they're trying to use every step they have, every tool in their box here to stop Putin from doing what he is doing here. And now, like you said, activating this NATO response force for the first time ever in their history, that since 1949, I believe. It's a 40,000 troop strong force. We don't know yet how many will be deployed or when they will be deploying, but we know that 8,500 U.S. troops from that are on high alert. They've been on heightened alert here, waiting for that call and ready to go at a moment's notice if they need to help defend these NATO allies. And really, they're trying to bolster the areas there in Eastern Europe to show Vladimir Putin that they stand together. Their big message here is that they are united, both in what they're doing with the sanctions against Vladimir Putin, as well as their defense forces, and then their support to Ukraine. Although they aren't sending any boots on the ground, they are sending in military equipment and defensive support. We know that the U.S., the White House actually requested Congress tonight, saying that they want $6.4 billion in new funding to respond to Russia's war on Ukraine, including $3.5 billion for the Pentagon and another $2.9 billion to support Eastern European allies. And that's in addition to the $650 million in security aid and $52 million in humanitarian aid that the U.S. already pledged to Ukraine. And that's just over the last year. So they are trying to help in whatever ways they can, even though they aren't sending actual troops to fight in Ukraine here.
Yeah, I just wonder if President Biden really does believe President Zelensky when he says it might be his last night on this earth. So keep us posted if you hear anything from Washington. Kelly Meyer, I'm going to move on real quickly because it's anybody's guess at this point what Russia's next move is going to be in Ukraine. And it's everybody's worst fear what Russia must be planning for its other neighbors. Those former Soviet republics are part of NATO now, many of them, and only one man knows the plan. And that's Vladimir Putin. The former KGB agent and longest-serving Russian president has a stranglehold on Russia. And nothing happens without his say-so. But who is this man in the driver's seat? He's been described as both a savvy strongman and a war criminal. But today, it was Putin who was throwing names around, calling the Ukrainian president and his government junkies and neo-Nazis, somehow thinking that this is going to convince their Ukrainian army to mutiny against them. Not sure how, but that's what's being said. Putin also accusing the Ukrainians of using children and women and the elderly as human shields. Today, for his part, the Ukrainian president spoke with our president and thanked Joe Biden for supporting Ukraine and also for tossing in those extra personal sanctions against President Putin himself. But, and there's always a but, that Ukrainian president also released a video criticizing Ukraine's allies for not doing enough to help them in their time of need. He announced that he and his family are Russia's top targets and today told the leaders of the European Union again that this might be the last time they ever see him alive. So I want to talk about how both of these men became the leaders that they are, starting with Vladimir Putin. I'm joined now by two people who know an awful lot about Putin and how he operates. Jonathan Sanders is the former Moscow correspondent for CBS News and professor of journalism at Stony Brook University. When he was reporting in Russia, he had a young government minder who was assigned to him, and that minder's name was Vladimir Putin. His latest book is called The Russians Emerge. And also with me tonight, Michael Isikoff. He is the chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News. He's also the host of Skullduggery and Conspiracy Land podcasts. He's the author of the book Russian Roulette. Michael, I'm going to begin with you if I can. Lots of news today, important news. Those personal sanctions are not small. I think you heard me mentioning it in the segment before. It's also not small that that NATO activated the NATO response force. What does it say to you, however, in the larger end game plan for President Putin?
Yeah, look, I am not sure that these sanctions are going to deter Vladimir Putin all that much. The U.S. has a history of imposing sanctions on Russia and Putin's cronies going back to the annexation of Crimea in 2014. They obviously didn't stop Putin then, nor have they deterred him from doing this now. And look, Putin's personal finances are quite opaque. They are hidden through multiple layers of opacity and cronies who hide his money. So whether we're able to actually affect him all that much personally, I'm not all that optimistic. And I just have to say, actually, listening to your introduction, you talked about, you know, Putin is now in a category with, you know, the leaders of North Korea, Syria, Venezuela. Well, I don't see where our sanctions against them have had any effect on, you know, those countries' policies that we're trying to deter. So I'm just not, you know, as I said, I'm a little skeptical that we're going to deter him now. But I do think that, you know, the important thing to recognize here is this, what's happening now is part of a pattern for Putin. This is slow motion. You start with 2014 when he annexes Crimea and listen to his rhetoric then about the historic ties between Crimea and Ukraine and Russia. That was 2014. He was sanctioned. Then in 2016, he interferes in United States election. He cyber attacks, information warfare. He wasn't deterred from that. And here we are a few years later, and he's not stopped. So we'll see. But I don't see where the leverage that the United States is trying to use and Western allies is making much.
You make a great point. You do make a great point. Assad, Bashir, Kim Jong-un, and Maduro, they certainly do live the life of Riley, but they live it in isolation. And if there's one thing, Jonathan, maybe you know this because you know the man personally. He sort of was over your back watching your work. You know him more than any of us. I assume that this is not a man who wants to convert his hard currency into rubles and be isolated, because if you are in this category, you don't get a flight into those countries. You don't get to do business with those countries. The ripple effect of your isolation financially is actually pretty profound. And I just don't see Vladimir Putin as enjoying that level of pariahship.
Well, Ashley, first of all, I know Vladimir Putin from the 70s when I was on Fulbright and then Leningrad, not now St. Petersburg. I had a lot of people looking over my shoulder in the dozen years I worked as a correspondent in Moscow. But I don't think Mr. Putin was menially enough to watch over me. Nonetheless, let me tell you a few things about Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin's formative experiences in the tough streets of Leningrad, and he learned sambo, a kind of judo or karate, early on. The more that somebody yells and calls him names, the cooler and more calculating he gets. He is absolutely ruthless. He is ruthless. He bombed Chechnya into the Stone Age. He did the same thing in Syria. He doesn't care about collateral damage at all. You could certainly see that in the hostage siege in Beslan. But He's not going to be totally isolated. First of all, he's got a huge 175,000 square foot house in the south of Russia that he built for himself. Second, I would not be surprised to see him show up at the United Nations General Assembly in the fall because he has to be allowed into the United States according to our agreement. Look, he's doing a lot of evil in the world, but calling him evil is not going to change anything. And what we can change in the United States is what we can control. I think that we've made a huge number of mistakes in this entire episode. The Russian Pacific Fleet has steamed all around Africa to show up in the Black Sea. That takes a couple of months. Why in those couple months didn't we appoint a full-time ambassador to Kiev? Someone like, let's say, David Petraeus, who both has Army knowledge and CIA clearance. We don't have a full-time ambassador there. Why don't we think about something different? Let's say that even if Putin is exaggerating, even he's exaggerating 80%, he thinks that America's controlling Ukraine. Okay, so we have something to do with 20% of the action there. The last time Washington and Moscow faced off about a country like this was in the 1950s about Austria. I don't know if you've ever been to Austria, Ashley, but the people live pretty nicely there. With the two countries agreed both to pull out of Austria and to make it neutral. And I think that's where we're headed, some kind of negotiation. But it's not going to be easy. The Ukrainians are putting up tough resistance, and there is something in the Slavic soul that likes martyrdom, and they're certainly going to have some of their own martyrs. It's just getting to be daylight in Ukraine, and it's going to be a fierce day of fighting. Before they take the president, I would expect them to take the TV center and the TV tower there.
That's definitely one of the first things that usually happens. Jonathan Sanders, thank you for your insight tonight. We appreciate it. I'm going to ask you, Michael, to hold on and stay with me for a moment because I want to turn my focus now to the Ukrainian side and to President Volodymyr Zelensky. I want to bring in Dana Kennedy into the conversation. She's a national writer for the New York Post, and she's covered President Zelensky extensively since 2019. Also with me, Andriy Dobryansky. He's the head of UN Affairs at the Ukrainian World Congress. All right. So, Dana, I want to begin with you, if I can. You know, I don't know if a lot of Americans know this, but the president of Ukraine just a few years ago was the top-rated comedian on television in Ukraine. How has it translated?
Well, it's a pretty crazy story, Ashley, that a lot of people still don't know. He starred in a satirical comedy called Servant of the People. Prior to this, he was a comedian. He had his own comedy troupe. But in Servant of the People, he played like a 30-something high school teacher who made a video ranting about corruption in Ukraine. And in the show, one of his students put it online, and it went viral, and the guy was elected president of Ukraine. And he was still on this show in 2019, the same year he was elected to the real presidency of Ukraine, which is really, really crazy. He was bankrolled in part, or should I say allegedly bankrolled in probably great part, by one of Ukraine's most fearsome oligarchs, a guy named Igor Kolomoisky, who has his own insane story. He's so ruthless that he keeps a shark tank in his office to intimidate anybody that might come in there. But, you know, it's just imagine if Pete Davidson all of a sudden, you know, became president of, you know, the United States or even a small country. It's kind of a similar sort of vibe. But the crazy thing is, Ashley, he's acquitted himself really well. I've talked to quite a few people since all this has happened, and they said even prior to this whole crisis, and obviously you can't get much of a bigger crisis if you're the president of a country like Ukraine, he did really well. I mean, he's got a history of being a lightning rod, and he's no stranger to international scandal. Because if you recall, Ashley, his infamous phone call with President Trump is what led to basically Trump's first impeachment, if you recall all that. And now he's been thrust in the most unlikely position of all as a wartime leader who, as you've alluded to twice, is saying he might not live to see tomorrow. And he gave really impassioned speeches 3 hours before Vladimir Putin's tanks and cruise missiles and all that hit various cities in Ukraine, he gave this really powerful speech to both the Russians in Russia and his own people. And the irony of ironies is he's a native Russian speaker. He comes from southeastern Ukraine, and he has basically become more of a nationalist. But because he's a native speaker, he spoke to the Russians in Russia in their native language, telling them, what are you doing? What are you letting this person do? But he's, as you also alluded to, he's not letting the U.S. off the hook. In fact, today he said, after even talking to President Biden, he said, we are defending our country alone. Just like yesterday, the most powerful country in the world looked on from a distance. He's taking to the streets with his staff. He's doing really everything you should do. You'd think this guy was a career politician. He's actually pretty impressive. And I hope he survives.
So, well, I think a lot of people hope he survives. Andriy, that brings me to you and the trust of the Ukrainian people. I mean, Dana really laid that out, that sure, people might have thought, what on earth have we just done, when they woke up and elected a comedian? But he has prosecuted his position really quite with remarkable navigation since the Trump call and then obviously through this. What do the Ukrainian people think of him in terms of the trust factor? Because the bullets are flying, and now is when it's really the most important. This is when it really counts. Do they have faith?
I think the way he has performed recently, very much so. You can see the trust in people. I'd like to clarify that I don't like the word comedian all the time. Let's say comedic actor. He has a range. He started with Dancing with the Stars. So there's a bunch of things he did before becoming president. However, his big wild card isn't just him not being a politician, but the fact that he hasn't been involved at any meetings. So that, in my opinion, threw Putinov at the first meeting that they had, the summit of the Normandy format, right after Zelensky was elected. It was about 8 months afterwards. And this was the first time that Putin had to go up against somebody who has no political experience. He had gone up against neophyte presidents, but both George W. Bush and Obama had political experience. They were politicians before. This was literally a person that had never been a politician and now is. So there's not a long track record for Putin to develop a sense, their intelligence service, to understand a sense of what this person is made of. I think they kind of feel they've gotten a better understanding, especially manipulating the public over the last several years. You also have to understand that this is a country just like every other country that underwent COVID, right? So, but unlike many powerful Western economies, this is a country that did not have its own vaccine. And they were being offered a Russian vaccine. And Putin and Zelensky obviously had to turn that down, because Lord knows what Putin was going to put in those vaccines offered to the Ukrainian people. We were very wary of the Chinese vaccines at the same time. But Ukraine was not on anybody's top list. So some of that brashness that you alluded to earlier, that came out in, again, scolding the West of saying, listen, are you our ally, or should we turn to China and Russia in terms of the vaccine? So that also, if you're talking about what his popularity was, that's part of the entire picture. And then we go right into this deep war for the last 6 months of buildup into this.
Michael, I want you to just button this up, if you will, for me. That I opened the show with the quote that I found to be just sad and chilling at the same time. The fate of Ukraine is being decided tonight. Well, it's tonight, and we're heading into the dawn, and it's usually pretty bad in the dawn hours, as the last few nights have shown us. What is the cost to President Putin if he actually does decide to kill President Zelensky and his cabinet and the Ukrainian leadership? Does it matter? Is it worth it to the international community if Putin does this?
Well, if he went that far, I think a lot of people would be shocked, and that as extreme as what he's done in the last few days, to go that far seems like it would be a bridge too far. But I do think that the Ukrainian, in the short term, you know, there's no question that Putin has achieved his aims, his most short-term aims here. He's declared these independent republics. Russian troops are on the ground. They're going to protect them. And he's going to pressure Zelensky and the Ukrainians to sign some sort of neutral status agreement that might keep them in power nominally in the short term. But there's long-term costs to Putin that he probably has not fully appreciated. The cost of an insurgency against Russian troops occupying Ukraine, you know, that's a prescription for a replay for the Russians of Afghanistan, in which, you know, a war of attrition against Russian troops dying, that's going to hit. And look at what's happened on the home front in Russia. Thousands of people protesting against this. That Russian tennis player you just cited at the top of the show, you know, hundreds being arrested. There is clearly not full backing among the Russian people for what Putin is doing here. And that's going to, you know, that's going to carry some real cost for Putin. So I think at this point, that's the only thing that will make a difference. But it's going to be in the long term. It's not going to be in the short term. In the short term, he's achieved his aims.
Can't thank you enough, Michael Isikoff, Dana Kennedy, and Andriy Dobryansky. All three of you have just been very helpful as we get into some uncharted territory here. So thank you very much. You know, Michael just said something about the tennis player, and I'm going to be honest with you. I did not know this little thing that happened today, but it was super interesting, and then it became very, very interesting. There's something called a special moment for a pro tennis player. A tennis player named Andriy Rublev closed out a semifinal match today at the Dubai Championships. Now, I know you're wondering, what does that have to do with, you know, what's going on in Ukraine? It has a lot. He's going to advance to the finals, and he's going to have a shot at $500,000 prize, and that's awesome. If you didn't know him before today, you're about to know him, and you're going to see a lot about him. You're going to hear a lot about him, because Rublev took his special moment. That's when they get to go up to the camera, and they actually write on it. Tennis players get to write on the camera lens. That's just something they do. He took his special moment, and he made it a special moment for the world. Take a look at what he decided to write.
Two sets, but Rublev said not so fast. And he might just have a message, Andrei Rublev. I think we can get behind that.
You heard the announcer say, and we can get behind that. No war, please. Well, maybe not everybody's going to get behind that, because there's definitely one person who is not going to get behind that, and that's Rublev's president, Vladimir Putin. Those who have criticized Vladimir Putin publicly, those Russians who have criticized him publicly in the past, have paid a pretty hefty price for doing so. Without question, Andrei's probably focusing right now on his opponent for that finals match tomorrow, but that opponent may be Andrei's least worry at this point. What will life be like for this tennis star when he heads back to Mother Russia? And, you know, just who's going to find fault in that celebratory graffiti? That story is coming up next. And later, what a way to start life. Medically fragile newborns rushed into a basement storage room as a bunker because their hospital ward was under fire in Ukraine. Become quite a tradition in professional tennis for players who've just won big matches. They get to write a little something on the lens of the TV camera. You know, whatever comes to mind, like an autograph or a joke, a little picture. It usually appears backwards for the viewers at home, but they typically figure it out. It's so common, actually, that the special pens they use are actually safe for the camera lenses. They're supplied to the players so that they can do their thing. What's really uncommon, though, is when the message is politically charged. Enter Andriy Rublev, the seventh-ranked tennis player in the world, ranked second in his homeland of Russia. He is just a major celebrity in Russia, huge. So you can imagine how his message, "No war, please," went over with his president, Vladimir Putin, who is currently slaughtering thousands of Ukrainians in an all-out assault right across that country, right? Just imagine you're watching that. And then you're seeing it on the news. And if Andre winds up winning the Dubai Championship tomorrow, there could be something other than a parade waiting for him in his home city of Moscow. Joining us now is Judy Kurtz. She is the In the Know columnist for The Hill. Judy, what do you think awaits Andre when he gets home?
That's a good question. I think, you know, it takes a lot of strength to be able to do a good backhand, a good serve. But it takes true guts, Ashley, to be able to speak out, especially when you don't know the consequences that you could face back at home.
Yeah, his doubles partner, I didn't realize this, is a young man by the name of Denis Molchanov. I don't think I'm pronouncing it right, but regardless, he's Ukrainian. And it just opens up so many thoughts about what these two could represent or whether it matters a lick to Vladimir Putin.
I think it does matter. You know, if you breathe the wrong way, it might matter to Vladimir Putin. But it's definitely a show of unity, especially in these tumultuous is too light a word, in these dreadful times that we're seeing. And I think that the tennis stars realize that the show of unity between the two countries, especially right now, is so important.
Mm. So it turns out a lot more people are protesting on the streets of Russia now. So, you know, not every Russian likes what President Putin's doing. There are plenty who do not. The daughter of Putin's spokesman decided to come out and put on her social media, "No war, please," and then promptly took it down. But that tells you just how high that issue goes. And then another big, huge Russian sports celebrity, probably well known to Americans, is Alexander Ovechkin. He's a captain of the Washington Capitals. He's a left winger, huge star. He actually is a bit of a fan of Putin. His social media profile picture is him and Putin together. This is what he said. He said, "It's a hard situation. I have family back in Russia, and it's scary moments, but we can't do anything. We just hope it's going to be end soon, and everything is going to be all right." He said that, but he also said, "No war, please. Please, no more war. Doesn't matter who's in the war. Russia, Ukraine, different countries. I think we live in a world like we have to live in peace and a great world." So it matters when someone like Ovechkin says, "Please, no more war," even if he's not going to call out Putin. But he also has a wife, kids, and parents in Russia. Do you think that's why he's not going all the way?
Oh, it's actually more surprising for Ovechkin because he has been a big Putin supporter in the past. Listen, Russian athletes are expected to toe the line and support Vladimir Putin no matter what. That's just what is expected of them. And if they fail to do that, there could be real consequences at home. Their family could be in jeopardy. They could face backlash in Russia. Here in the U.S., when celebrities or prominent figures tend to get political, we might do like a massive eye roll. In Russia, this is life or death. And these prominent figures, these athletes, could actually be affecting real change from their words.
Yeah, you think going into the boards is scary. You know, going on record is a lot scarier for some of these folks. So Judy Kurtz, thanks so much for being on tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ashley.
Still ahead tonight, the most fortunate Ukrainian orphan you might ever see, and the many now utterly, helplessly dependent on the fortunes of war. Look at them. Just look at them. Welcome back. Spending your nights and or your days in a bomb shelter is something nobody wants, something nobody should ever have to do. But what if they're your very first days and nights ever on this earth? I want to show you a hospital basement in a city in eastern Ukraine that was targeted by Russian missiles. Those are babies, and not just babies, they're newborns, and not just newborns, they are newborns in fragile health. They were hustled downstairs to a makeshift bomb shelter in the storage room from their neonatal intensive care unit. You know that as the NICU. So there they are beside the, you know, boxes and the storage and the dust and the God knows whatever else is in that basement, all wrapped up in whatever blanket they can find, with nurses pumping oxygen into them and keeping them safe underground. The head of that unit says, "This is our reality." And now I want to take you to a different hospital and a very, very different reality. Among the patients at University Hospital in San Antonio, Texas tonight is 4-year-old special needs Ukrainian orphan. Strike that. Former Ukrainian orphan who has no earthly idea yet just how lucky he is. That is Ruslan Jaggi. He's the newly adopted son of a San Antonio couple who first saw his picture on a website called Reese's Rainbow. And they just couldn't get him out of their minds or their hearts. Getting him out of Ukraine, however, that almost didn't happen. The Jaggies went to the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine a week and a half ago to pick up their baby. They got Ruslan's visa. That's what they were there for. And it wasn't ready, so of course they had to wait. 5 o'clock came and went, and still they waited. And more time passed, and the Jaggies assumed that they were going to have to leave and come back to the embassy the next day. But then their names were called, and Ruslan got his paperwork, which is lucky indeed, because the very next day the embassy closed because war was coming. Ruslan Jaggi, 4 years old, malnourished, anemic, with cerebral palsy, was the luckiest recipient of the last American visa from the Kyiv embassy, at least for now. His parents say it is just nothing short of a miracle. Sadly, thousands of Ukrainian orphans, special needs and otherwise, are still awaiting their miracles. Even the best-staffed, best-equipped orphanages like these are no match for Russian tanks and missiles. After a break, I'll be joined by an American aid worker who is waiting out the war in the same Ukrainian city as the infants and children for whom he is trying desperately to find families and save their lives. He's going to join us next. No one could be more helpless than an abandoned newborn unless it's an abandoned newborn in the middle of a war zone. For more than 15 years now, a Nevada-based group called Abundance International has been a lifeline for two Ukrainian orphanages, providing money and medicine and manpower and equipment, and maybe most importantly, a huge amount of hope. It's never been easy, but it has never been harder than right now. Joining me from Nikolaev, Ukraine, in the southern part of that country, is Abundance International's founder and director, Mark Edward Davis. Mark, first and foremost, are you safe tonight?
I am. Thank you for asking. We did have the bomb siren scare last night, so we had the lights down, get off the streets, and of course heard some of those sounds of war in the background. We just hope when we come out this morning at daylight that everything is okay.
So let's talk about the orphanages. Are they safe? Are they okay? And how on God's green earth are the people who work there keeping those kids calm amid the horrible sounds?
Ashley, thank you. You really nailed it. And I let me explain. So many people ask me, how are the kids handling this? Well, the orphanages we support are just from newborn to 4 years old. So for them, they don't understand war. And so for them, it's more like a heavy storm of lightning and thunder, and you hear the noise, and a comforting parent has to come along and just say, it's going to be okay, honey, it's going to be okay. And the nurse has to be that solid, collected, calm spirit to add that energy to the child when she is freaked out. And so God bless these nurses for staying their duty and being that nurturing soul in their most difficult circumstance.
I mean, they're doing God's work. I look at these faces and I want them all. You know, I assume that everybody's watching right now thinks the same thing. What can I do? Yeah. I want one of those kids. But what's going on? I mean, is there a complete disruption mm-hmm. in the adoption process, that getting these kids into loving families where they deserve and need to be? Is it all in flux?
Everything is in flux right now. And we're 2 days into this, when the whole country here really did not believe this would happen. Because as you pointed out, Ashley, every Ukrainian has family and relatives in Russia. Every Russian has family and relatives here. We've seen for 8 years the noise and the posturing and the political bantering. Nobody believed it would actually come to war. And so we're still in shock and disbelief. But I will say the focus on the orphans is so key. And we contact the doctor who runs each institution, and they're fine. Their food supply is good for, you know, a while, 3 weeks to a month. And what we need to do is really shore them up because if I can, let me share my biggest fear in this right now. We've been caring for them, and we built ICU units, birthing centers, everything else we can to help these kids get a good life. We only cover a portion of the funding. The government has always been the undercurrent with the building facilities, the electricity, and, you know, the nursing staff. And the problem I see is we went in through COVID, and slowly even the food budgets were having to be eroded down, and we were stepping up more and more and more to help. My concern is we're in war. Is it really a priority in government to keep writing the checks to these? If there's a transition in government, has the new government already made this a priority to happen, or is this going to get lost in the bureaucratic shuffle as departments shut down in the events of war? And my concern is we have to really step up and be ready to step in to keep these kids taken care of. And this is why I love what you're doing. And AbundanceInternational.org, we're taking donations from just, all we do is we take it from people who love these kids. And this is what supports the work we're doing. And thousands have responded just over the last few days. And I'm just so grateful to see the outpouring of love.
Okay, double plug here, AbundanceInternational.org. It's up on the bottom there for anybody who wants to take a look at it. I know you've got GoFundMe available there as well, so people can link if they want to give money. The big concern that I keep thinking about, Mark, is that the financial system is just going to be a wreck. And how to get the supplies and the money and the things that those kids need through the streets strewn with tanks and ordnance, you know. How do you even know yet? I mean, we're so early. Do you even know what you're going to do?
Well, first of all, I can tell you a plan. And then, like you said, how can you absolutely say in this time that this is what will happen? However, we have verified the supply for now to get them through a few weeks. We all have to be off the roads for a little while. And so that's just the issue. Now, we've verified supply. So we can take donations and use, I got my American debit cards to use that account, and I can buy from there. I can also take out, you know, $4,000 a day in cash. And so the banks are all up. The internet is all up. Thank you that I can have this conversation. Cell phone systems are still up. So we have hope and faith that Putin intends on keeping those up in order to reestablish normalcy as quickly as possible if he is in charge. And if the Ukrainians hold their country, then obviously they want to maintain that as well. So I believe we can get the supplies to them when we need to make that happen.
Triple plug, AbundanceInternational.org. It's also on the screen, Mark, for anybody who wants to help. I'm going to keep touch with you, okay, to see how things are going.
Thank you.
And, you know, keep sending us pictures of those cute little babies.
Wonderful.
You're doing God's work, my friend. God bless you. Be safe there, okay?
Thank you.
Mark Edward Davis joining us tonight. And, you know, thinking about the orphans in Ukraine, it's hard to ignore the fact that many more children could be orphaned if up to the 50,000 or so people are killed in this Russian invasion. And it made us wonder how many orphans currently live in Ukraine. The answer is coming up. So before the break, we asked you how many orphans currently live in Ukraine. And the answer is over 100,000. I want to touch base now with my colleagues Marnie Hughes and Leland Vittert, who are going to continue our live coverage. Guys, I don't know if it chilled you to the bone like it did to me when the president of Ukraine said today, this might be the last time you see me alive. That just really, it really affected me like no other development today.